reading some of the memoir aspects of the autobiography, you covered a lot of things about the radio shows that you listened to, like there was the Lone Ranger and Escape. You and I are the same age.
Yeah, right.
Remember, my favorite Escape was, I don't know if you remember this one, it was the one in which a ship bumped into a lighthouse, and the ship, it was an abandoned ship, it was derelict, filled with rats.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember that one, but that was the scariest escape
yeah,
that I've ever heard.
That sounds
and the lighthouse keepers kept going up level by level to the top of the lighthouse as the rats covered.
Oh, they're coming, oh my God, yeah. But that sounds like one I heard.
Then I know you liked, or at least you listened to the Hit Parade, and there was Vaughn Monroe,
yeah.
And the movies, you cited Tyrone Power and Errol Flynn and Gregory Peck and
right.
so forth, all
right.
the actors that you and I grew up with back
right.
in the late 40s. And
standard American diet.
Right.
right.
But in continuing to read, I noticed that it really wasn't until Howard University and into the Air Force that you made reference to books, because I had the feeling that you did not have a literary environment as you grew up in Newark.
Not really. The books that I read, actually, aside from school works, were provided from two main sources. One, my grandmother, who worked for a wealthy white family up in Essex Fells, New Jersey, where they've got these huge brick walls. She brought down the collected works of Charles Dickens, H. Rider Haggard, Kipling, and what else from them. And that was my reading for a while. I mean, I would read through those books continuously. You know, the Dickens was, you know, very, very important to me. And H. Rider Haggard, strangely enough, she. And then my mother subscribed to the Book of the Month Club. And that's how I got to read Richard Wright at the time, because I think Native Son was a selection of the Book of the Month Club. Black Boy, you know, which were two of my earliest, you know, real influence. And Edgar Allan Poe, I remember reading all those stories in that, you know, collection that they gave out. And you know, some books that my grandfather had that were important to me. J.A. Rogers, his history of black folks that he used to have in his drawer. He also had a Masonic handbook and Kraft Ebing Psychopathia Sexualis, which I read at the tender age. So, you know, it was a very mixed kind of background, but it was not specifically a literary household by any means.
No, it sounds very literary. It's more literary than most of us.
Well, I mean, I think it was because there were books there from various sources, and I was drawn to read them. You know, I mean, the Book of the Month Club thing, I used to read the stuff my mother got all the time, Daphne du Maurier and Bennett Cerf's Try and Stop Me. I thought that was a great collection of stories, but I was always sort of peeping into that, but it was not, say, the kind of literary household that my own is now and my own kids have access to.
In your autobiography, there's a scene in the Air Force before you were discharged in which one of the superior officers looks through your locker and he finds a couple of books of poetry. What does he say to you?
Well, he wanted to know what was I doing reading those books. First he asked me, did I like it? What are you reading them? And he thought somehow that had to do with not being manly. He said, well, Jones, when are you going to stop reading this stuff, you know, and be a man, you know, which my fellow soldiers thought was immensely funny because they treasured the information they could get from me. They thought I was an encyclopedia, you know, having been to college before, and they would always be asking me questions, and they valued that, you know, especially a lot of the black troops, you know, from the ghettos. They thought it was great to have somebody along that could read all the forms and read all the documents and understand what was going on. And so when this guy said that, they thought that was, you know, funny, really, and somewhat of a harassment. But I think it was because it was unique to open a Foot Locker and see, you know, Dylan Thomas and T.S. Eliot, you know, in a soldier's Foot Locker.
During this period, you began to write your own poetry and
right.
then make submissions. What were the themes that you were developing with this early poetry?
Well, I think it, pretty much like what most young people's poetry is, these great abstract, you know, love, death, the future, mainly the kind of lyric poetry that young people write, you know, I feel, I hurt, I'm sensitive, you know, I want this, I don't want that, all about, you know, the great suffering I, you know. And I got some lessons in, you know, literary kind of procedure. I'd send poetry out and it would come back almost before it, I'd put it in the mailbox. It would shoot back at me, you know, with a rejection slip. I wish I'd kept all those.
You went to Manhattan in the mid-50s. You worked for a record collecting magazine.
Right.
And you got involved with a literary establishment.
Right.
There was Gilbert Sorrentino and Gary Snyder and some of the black mountain poets. Tell me about that period in your life. I would imagine you have a great sense of nostalgia for that period.
Well, not really. My own view, I see it as one, you know, aspect of my own growth and development. You know, I came to New York looking for, you know, world-class intellectuals. I mean, I had been, given to understand by my reading and so forth down in Puerto Rico where I was stationed that, you know, New York City and especially Greenwich Village, that's where, you know, all the great intellectual, life was happening. And so I came here looking, to be involved in the kind of artistic kind of situation that I envisioned in my head, you know, and I met a lot of writers, you know, a lot of painters, a lot of musicians in the village because there are a lot of them there. And I think it was definitely helped form my own, approach to writing, my own understanding of art and so forth. And I think it was a school, sort of, in one way. And to that extent, you know, it was a positive.
I know we don't have much more time, but tell me about your first published work. What was that, and what was it like when you first saw it in print?
Well, let me see. My first published work was a book called Preface to a 20-Volume Suicide Note, which was a book of a poetry. It included some of the first poems I had published in small magazines once I got out of the Air Force. I had joined forces with a bookstore, 8th Street Bookstore, no longer in existence, unfortunately. I became the publisher, the editor of a series of books of poetry. So mine was the first, and then I published Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac and Gary Snyder and, you know, a whole group of people, Frank O'Hara. I sold my interest in that company, unfortunately, you know. But it was powerful for me because once I had decided I was going to become a writer, actually to achieve that, it took some weight off me because one of the things I discovered when I came to New York is there were a lot of people floating around who only pretended to do the things that they said they were. There were painters who didn't paint, writers who never wrote, you know, composers who had never composed. And, I was thinking to my young self, well, look, I don't want to do this. I really have to, you know, be about this if I'm going to give my life to it. And so that first book was important to me, you know.
The language in your autobiography, it has the feeling of speech rather than being written. How did you compose it? Did you dictate it, or did you actually sit down and
No,
write
it? I wrote it. But that's what I wanted. You see, because the flavor of, especially, my early days, I wanted to try to preserve that in the kind of, the kind of language that it came back to me in, you know. I mean, the actual language of the people I knew and the streets that I lived on and, you know, the various groups that I related to. And because to me that brought it back more sharply, you know, because it gave more of a sense of place rather than, you know, a kind of standard, American English approach to it.
But actually you're speaking now in a different way than you have written the book.
Oh, sure, absolutely. I think most African-Americans are bilingual. I think people from any kind of group that's been generally on the outside of the mainstream usually can speak two languages. You know, I always tell that to my students. You know, I know you speak one way when you're in Columbia, but I know the minute, or, you know, Stony Brook, but the minute you leave the halls of Ivy, you know, you speak the language of the people you're with, and if you're Afro-American, you definitely have to speak that Afro-American dialect. You know,
so you have spoken, in effect, black English for the book, which is not necessarily the way you would speak in every environment.
No, absolutely not. I think that's important. For instance, my children grow up in a black community. You know, we live in a black community in Newark, and certainly on the sidewalks with their friends, I mean, they have to communicate one way, you know, the language of that particular group. And in another kind of environment, they have to communicate with the people. And certainly in this country, you know, if they can't communicate with the powers that be, they're going to be worse off than they are now. So it's a question really of Most educated blacks tend to be bilingual.
One last question, mm-hmm. and then I'll let you go. On page 120,
yeah.
There was something very illuminating in it that I liked a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was 120, or maybe it was 126. See, I had hoped to talk to you longer, so I made a lot of notes.
Oh, boy.
One, two, three. Oh, yes. This goes back to the language we're talking about.
Yeah.
White people's words, you write. Profound, beautiful, some even correct and important. But that is a tangle of non-self in that, for all that. You were obviously impressed with the language of the poets and the
mm-hmm.
writers, many
sure.
of which, most of which probably were white at that
mm-hmm.
time.
Absolutely.
And yet you found yourself facing some sort of decision, knowing that you didn't necessarily want to write like
them. No, because my experience was being left out, you see, and that was something I had to learn, you know, gradually. See, when I left college and went to the Air Force, I think that's really where I educated myself, because I didn't really have a value for education when I was in college, you know. But once I got in the service, then I developed this kind of real hunger for information. And I spent hours and hours and hours in the service when I was guarding airplanes and doing other very dull stuff, you know, 12 hours a day sometimes guarding those B-36s. I had nothing else to do, and I would read, read, read. I mean, sometimes I would read 12, 14 hours a day, you know, things that I would never dream of doing, never have the time to do outside. You know, if you want to read all of Marcel Proust or the complete works of Herman Melville or, you know, even the most obscure works of Thomas Hardy, you know, you never have a chance to do that unless you were some kind of graduate student. And I found after doing that that a lot of the kind of measures, let's say, my perspective had been shaped by that, you know, and through a kind of intellectual process that was not directly hooked up with the real life, you know, of my own mind, you know, which began in a different place and has always had strong emotional, organic, you know, ties with the people in the life of that particular place. Talking about, of course, the black community and Afro-American, you know, culture.